Good morning, and we are live. It is Friday, August 5th, 8 a.m. to be exact, 2022. Did I say that I'm coming at you live from Belgrade, Serbia? I may have mentioned that once or twice before. And today I'm doing a cleanup on questions, new questions today. A lot of these are standing questions that I haven't gotten to being able to answer. And a few questions that maybe at least one from 2 days ago on our when we talked about the Great Reset. And I'm going to look at the kind of the volume of questions and see if that expands. And now I'm going to adjust kind of how thoroughly or succinctly. I should always be as succinct as possible. I'm not. A lot of times in the flow of language and in the process of speaking, a lot of lateral existent information related to the subject helps, you know, it colors it out and gives it fullness and context. And those, you know, somehow arrive on my palate, those words and ideas arrive on my palate, like as if in a stream of consciousness or from the ether or something. And that's just how it be. But I'm going to be like a little targeted for you here today, just to, what's up? Do I have like an accent? Did I wake up with an accent? Did I have a fucking stroke last night in my sleep? Maybe it's not enough coffee. I sound extraordinarily Mexican all of a sudden. So this great reset. So we have some questions. And the one that I picked up from G a few days ago, this is somebody who is a listener and supporter who had attended, has educational professional background in the area of the study of or implementation of things relating to AI for IR, at least looking at these industrial revolutions. And so the question is always well-informed. And this is the first question. And welcome and good morning. This is like what we're doing here. The first question is very well-informed. Let's dig in. This is about, this says question. Do you think that the goal of the fourth industrial revolution is actually dependent on the position or side you're on? So I looked at that question once, and there's a lot more to the question. I think that question is asking, like, is it a matter of perception? And I would say that the desire, like our what we want out of a fourth industrial revolution, is dependent on the relationship to society today. But yeah, I mean, it's not the goal that changes, but it's, you know, our goals are dependent. Yeah. So there isn't like the goal. I think it's more like a syntax issue. I think I understand the question. Forgive me for being so literal. The false dichotomy that's being presented is ugly fourth industrial revolution, right? And the ugly great reset versus going back to how things were before. But I have a question for you about the way things were before. Would you call the way things were before a great awakening? Or would you call the way things were before the conditions which required our awakening? I would articulate that these were the conditions which required our awakening. So it's a false dichotomy to pose either the Great Reset / 4IR or going back to the way things were before. Now, certainly with the things that were being rolled out as the new normal, when you had either Schwab doing those weird anti-public relations snippets or Bill Gates being interviewed and saying, this is a fantasy that things will ever go back to the way things were before. I think that's what Schwab said. This is pure fantasy to think that in the total weight of all historical developments that we can go back to how things were before. This is a fantasy. This is ridiculous. So you have these Schwabian characters who consistently perform very poorly on market testing. Why? Because we have a gut reaction to bald-headed, fucking Indiana Jones, Nazi glasses, bespeckled-looking motherfuckers speaking like that. That's why. It's very obvious. It's just what it looks like. Just central casting. Just think central casting and just understand that so much of our reality is central casting. Like, when you look at somebody and what it makes you think and how it makes you feel, that's the point. Yeah, there's sometimes you get some miscasting. I can give you an example, maybe, of miscasting, although I would debate, I don't know, that's a good one. Jacinda Ardern in New Zealand, she has programmed herself to make a concerned face. You know, like, I'm concerned, but it pops up because it's robotic, right? Because she's not concerned about fucking jack shit, right? Which is very bizarre, because when people ask me, Joaquin, you know, like, you're 45 years old, and, you know, you don't always seem that way. And I say, well, you know, some of it's genetics, but I don't worry about things. Why? Because I'm not up to no good. That's why. You know, being evil is a lot of fucking work. Working for evil people is a lot of work, because you're constantly, and that's what most people experience, by the way, with stress, talking about oxidative stress, free radicals, aging, cortisol, hormones, enzymes, mineral depletion from stress, not getting to sleep by 10 p.m., not sleeping those solid 5 hours, you know, that you need between, let's say, 10 or 11 p.m. and 3 and 4 a.m., talking about your circadian rhythm. People don't know this stuff. They don't know, you know, and then they think they need a Coca-Cola or a Zoloft. And that's just, you know, but that's, I think people figure out that even a little bit of water is, you know, is good. Like a lot of water, you know, three liters a day is a good starting point. And a lot of electrolytes. So, you know, looking at the Great Reset and looking at what the Schwabians, in terms of our perspective of it, it's a very good question, G. And I reposted it in the comments. I said, I told you the other day I would answer it. So this is the rest of, he goes on with the question. The World Economic Forum is aiming for the programming of the biological human being to be extended with biotech inserted into them, like what we're talking about. Well, I remember Johnny Mnemonic with, I'm sorry to interrupt, OG, but remember Johnny Mnemonic? Who was that with? Keanu Reeves? Remember the fucking dolphin? Remember the dolphin that was wet-wired and we were all, like, you know, communing with the dolphin and the majestic beings from outer space or whatever the hell dolphins are? Johnny Mnemonic. So he goes, so these wet wires, these extended, you know, talking about programming biotech inserted into people to develop the human robot, zombie Frankenstein, he says, and he goes on. On the other hand, it is the human who was there first to feed AI systems like 3PT3. Oh, that's the that's AI. That's called deep learning. That's a deep learning language thing. By the way, GPT-3 for people out there. You know, there's a you can access GPT-3. You know, in programming, right? With the like open AI APIs out there, but a lot of people are getting into that end of tech, talking about automated learning and deep learning, like basically just the layers of complexity in the programming such that the language or language immersion or language acquisition of the AI is such that it can construct, you know, natural language based upon enough samples of it, like based on what you feed it. And it can create original text based on that. So he's talking about, so you have humans who were there first to feed these AI systems, like these self-learning systems, is what he's saying. Last year, with a huge load of information that is eventually is turning out to be merely a representation of a static system that was fed, right, that was educated into it up until a certain point, not knowing anything about COVID, for example, okay? So that kind of AI is always limited in a static manner. He's just saying basically it's limited to what you feed it and doesn't know the things. It can't acquire or access information in the outside world based upon real questions that really arise out of a real interaction with the world. So that's very different, you know, in self-learning that maybe only derive information from dialogue or something like that, and or language recognition, and you know, or there's many different ways that can work. But so he has a point here, right? That AI is hyped. He's asking, AI is hyped as it is in us humans, who are actually the ones who should be allowed to shape and educate the AI with our ethics and values, right? This is the setup and the question, do we want to let somebody program us, or are we going to use the tools to program tech the way we think fits our lives and future goals? We all want and need the fourth industrial revolution. Yeah, I mean, the thing is that technologies by itself are not inherently good. And even labor-saving technologies are not inherently good if the people don't do good things with their time that they get out of that. I mean, there's nothing inherently good about things that are not human beings. Like, only human beings can do good or bad in the world. So, you know, we can be acting under influences and they can be divine and not so divine. And those are supernatural forces. So when you talk about the interaction of AI and supernatural forces, think about how it works when you have an AI programmed by people who are under, you know, who are possessed. In kind of neo-Yiddish, neo-Kabbalah studies and interest in Judaica, you have this kind of resurgence of this look at the golem, you know, as a defender of Jewish people. But this idea, it's very similar to the Mickeys. We talked about the Sorcerer's Apprentice and stuff like that, and creating these systems that we can't stop. The golem is a good, you know, the golem is made of clay, you know, very kind of similar. It's kind of weird because Adam is made of clay. And it's kind of like a Frankenstein's monster, but it doesn't have consciousness the way that you would think. It might simulate, I mean, talking about new interpretations in studies of artificial intelligence, and you know, a lot of people in that field of interest who also have been exposed to, you know, Central European Judaica and stuff like that because of their ancestry. So you have that actual example of the golem comes up in some of these kind of tech communities, because of the representation of people in there that would have a, you know, connective reference point to that in Judaica. But I think this is very important and good because it connects these questions of, like, what are we really doing? And in reality, and I think you're alluding to it, but the technology is way behind where they say it is, and the ability to do something like human learning or human consciousness is far beyond the upwards imaginable capabilities of quantum computing or whatever, you know, the buzz, whatever the sales gimmick is du jour, whatever's on the offering is always overhyped. And we talk about how, just in general, how everything, you know, any these, you know, Web3 venture capitalist firms talk about blockchain, this and that. And this is, these are, you know, it's not that these are new or anything. This is stuff from the 70s. A lot of the conundrums, or like social possible, like possible social crises that will occur from AI has been explored in literature and fiction. There is, of course, Terminator, with Skylink. There is, you know, The Matrix. I know that in the world of fan fiction, people have like put those together as like kind of one story. And then you have this understanding of man almost in search of his father through the quest of trying to imitate this magical ability to create life, something that women can do inherently. And so it seems that there is this, rather than just being satisfied with children, as like, wow, that's the miracle. We had, you know, we made life, right? There's a strange drive, and it's a very, for whatever reason, male-dominating drive to do this, like, Frankenstein's monster thing. And it's kind of interesting because, you know, Mary Shelley had kind of big issues with men. And nevertheless connected a lot of dots and landed these things. And maybe you would say because of these issues and kind of pointing out, some of this madness and where it leads. And it's true. I mean, AI is static and, it can be fooled and we've gotten so used to associating how a person interacts with consciousness and the simulation of consciousness or the simulation of interacting with a person, talking about like these deep learning GPT-3 language systems. But that's a focus on like a person, like on labor-saving technology of a real person interacting just with a press one now. If you'd like to go back to the main menu, press 4 now. Say yes if you'd like to continue. That's the thing that you're actually talking about. It's really very low level. So that kind of stuff, they might talk about, oh, this is like, you're not going to know, you're not talking to a person. But that only speaks to the shallowness of the interactions that people have in the public square, like during doing, you know, market function, which is fine. You know, I'm not here to tell you my fucking life story. Sell me the thing you have to sell. I can go to a kiosk. I don't need to believe that it's a human being in the Coke machine to pop in. I'm going to date myself 50 cents. It's like whatever, $1.90. Right. So there's kind of a weird thing of the industry and the hype and the gimmick and the wow, kind of like, but it's very dated right away. Right. Like when you look at movie trailers from 15 years ago, like all these fucking Transformers and Marvel shit that, you know, mentally retarded 14-year-olds, you know, high on sugar, walking around with fucking Colorado baseball hats and fucking whatever the hell is going on with the gente these days. Dude, how come fat Mexican kids are so much into Marvel Universe? You see them with all this... Yeah, you see them with, like, fucking red candy shit all over their face. I don't understand it, but, you know, I guess it's a you know, kids, right? But the thing that's weird is that you have a bunch of, like, 35 and 50-year-old adult kids that think that they're getting, I guess they're entertained, you know? You can't think that you're being entertained, can you? I mean, you either are or you aren't, right? Yeah, well, by the grace of God, go I. But, you know, it's like, so, remember those trailers, there was like all CG, right? All CGI. And today, when you look at them, you're like, that's awful. This, what did they make this? Nothing looks like there's any gravity to it. It's just a bunch of images flipping around. It just looks like a whirl of pen art or something. It doesn't look like action. And that's very similar to how our experience is every time that we're past the wow factor and look at just AI from 3 years ago, we're like, how did we even think this was close to the thing? Like, this is so bad, guys. This is so bad. But it kind of gets, you have the tech industry and these fairs and, you know, how that bleeds into the gaming industry, for example. Games are leading, you know, video games lead the way. Pornography leads the way. On internet bandwidth, video games lead the way on a lot of programming, graphics, and things like that. They definitely sell video cards that way, and they keep, you know, pushing the envelope. It's a very market driven function, very entertainment driven. It doesn't not work. It's totally fine in that sense of things. But you don't have half of or a fraction of the goods that are promised with any of this, and very like with any kind of hype driven thing, where you're using the wow factor to build, you know, a velocity, that's very much like this stuff they're talking about with the fourth industrial revolution. I got an email question after doing a deep session with Matt Arrett's group that on doing a long answer question session, and it came up, these things came up, and one of them was, I got an email because I said, guys, just email me follow-ups, and he's saying, you know, what do you think about, because there's fifth generation warfare, you know, what do you think about fifth generation whatever, I don't know, like fifth generation peace fair or something like that. And you know, I still have to make a response, but I, you know, we're not in the territory of fourth fucking generation anything militarily. This is all hype to talk about fifth generation warfare, and it's hype. It's very misleading. Okay, how people play with these categories, and it's very similar to when we exposed the dissonance and disconnect between how the World Economic Forum viewed the third industrial revolution versus how the fourth industrial revolution is viewed, and how that's inconsistent with the concept of industrial revolutions by, you know, numerating them, and that they're going through time. That's not, Schwab did not invent that, and the World Economic Forum did not invent that, and Jeremy Rifkin did not invent that. It does have its origins in Marxian, you know, historical political economy. And in that sense, the Schwabians are doing some type of, you know, Marxianism or whatever you want to call it with that towards these corporatist, post-corporatist aims. But when you look at, you know, your statement, because you have a good question, and a lot of positive statements, a lot of statements of fact. You're saying that the AI is hyped as it is us humans, right? Who are actually the ones who should be allowed. You see, they're trying to make it seem like, and I think there's a TV show like this too, that people are all, it's like the future and people are so inherently religious that we need these programmed atheist cyborgs to keep us from killing each other with our, it's like this very stupid Christopher Hitchens post, it's actually very anti-historical. It's nowhere close to Marxism, despite that Christopher Hitchens at one time was a Trotskyite. You know him as a very big atheist asshole. But his arguments are actually very poor. Obviously, there are better arguments for atheism than the one that Hitchens in his primitive state offers. But there are also many better proofs of God than come out of, the attempts in the tradition of American kind of like evangelism / Scopes Monkey Trial type shit to kind of prove the flaws of the contemporary approach. So there's a lot of, problems in there. But obviously, robots or AI computers, generally speaking, are going to behave as programmed unless there's a bug and then they crash. They don't normally do like the wrong thing. They normally just stop functioning. They crash. And just like bugs in programming, those are created by people. These aren't like some natural thing that happens. Bugs are not produced, organically from the program's interaction with the world. No. So that's very different. AI doesn't have an interaction with the world. And that's really the whole the false sales or whatever you want to call it, the misrepresentation of AI is very limited. And a lot of things, even like forensic sciences, are very limited, and we're getting into a place that, see, the biggest danger, of course, we're talking about coercive and the belief, this mystical belief in technology, that technology is unbiased, when we know that AI is only going to behave like you're going to have an AI judge and, it's going to be fair. No, it's just going to be programmed to deliver the outcomes that you give it. So whatever biases that you have programmed into it are going to be the biases that they have. They're not inherently fair. Justice is a human quality. Okay? Justice is a human quality in the world. So it's a very good question about whether we are going to let the computer program us, or whether we're going to program the computer. They want to pretend it's almost like the elites are going to pretend that they're going to admit their own bias in decision making. And so let's have a computer decide what's the more fair allocation of rights and resources, right? But it's going to just be how it's programmed. I think that's a very basic point that people can appreciate. We've talked at length about this, what a real fourth industrial revolution looks like. And we're not sold that this has to be called the 4IR, nothing like that. We're just helping people conceptually call it whatever works, just understand what it is. And as long as you're not defining it at odds with the things that kind of other similar-minded people are doing towards the same goals as you in what you're trying to stop or the type of better world that you want to see built, you have to be flexible with your terminology. I just say 4IR to show how even within their own rubric and their own logic system, there's all these problems. And also to show that the World Economic Forum didn't come up with this idea of industrial revolutions. So they've hijacked that. And then they're kind of making us think that that entire frame of reference of understanding things is wrong. And although there's many things wrong with their suppositions and the premises that they have on a whole range of technological, moral, ethical things, okay, the basic idea that new technologies are going to shape law and culture and the economy in new ways is like can't be debated, right? So then it's a question of which ways, not that we can go back to how things were before. A nuclear war could probably accomplish that for those who survive far enough away from fallout. Then you can go back to medieval period or whatever, but we're only delaying and we're only then kicking down the road the redevelopment of society, because this could have happened, you know, just hypothetically, and obviously the fossil record could be wrong, but you have anatomically modern human beings on the planet for about 250,000 years, and we only have, if you, by the conventional record, you talk about, you know, ancient Egypt or the Indus River civilization, so you have things going back 10,000 BC, 12,000 BC, and we can speculate what those cultures were all about, okay? But that's only a fraction, that's 10,000, 12,000 years out of 250,000 years. So that's less than 5% of the overall time that human beings have been on Earth. So here, and we're talking anatomically modern. People sometimes don't understand what that means. They think the anatomical means standing upright and having two arms, but they're still fucking cavemen. No, no, no. Anatomically modern refers to, basically Cro-Magnon / Homo sapiens sapien, basically just the Homo sapiens. The same brain. In other words, people like you and I, probably just denser bone and a different hormonal profile, but these things are very environmentally determined, and also there seems to be maybe a shorter epigenetic lifespan that might kind of produce some spikes based upon conditions during prenatal conditions or acquired conditions of the parent during life, that the child might be hairier or more robust or something like this. Okay, more neurotic or less neurotic, more robust or less robust. Those seems to be the kind of like the differences that produce, the some of the cognitive differences in variation in anatomically modern human beings. But these are people having, in other words, this conversation that you and I are having right now, people 250,000 years ago were cognitively capable of this conversation. Do you understand? So that's what anatomically modern means. And that's 250,000 years by the fossil record. And I know there's errors in it, okay? I'm the first one to say it, but it could be a shorter period of time. But how much shorter? Maybe half? Who knows? Could it be longer? I mean, you have kind of more, kind of like on the edge of anti-canonical learning, totally heretical stuff. You have people like Michael Cremo who have an interest in Hinduism and look at the Vedic records, and they think that these cycles of history and that human beings have been on the planet for, 1,000,000, 3,000,000, whatever, 10 million years, let's say. But let's condense that, and we just to talk about just the anatomically modern human beings over the past 250,000 years, and how many times did they, figure out how to build cities, how to build this, I mean, imagine for a minute that the moon is a physical location that can be arrived at by crafts, or that we can get to the moon. I mean, or we have, I'm not a moonologist, but, imagine one day we do get to the moon, and then we find, all these 200,000-year-old human bases that were built 200, you know what I'm saying, when humanity was only 50,000 years old 200,000 years ago. So how many times have we gone through a process of creation and destruction? How many cycles have we gone through this time, Are we suffering from, like in the film, what was it, where the guy wakes up every day and his memory is blank? We're basically a race suffering from amnesia. I know that, you know, kind of people on the edge, not as wild as Michael Cremo, but people like, what's his face, who's all into the Egyptology, Graham Hancock. He says that, you know, we're a race suffering from amnesia. It's very interesting because it raises questions about, Memento was the film. It raises questions about things that we think are recent that may have happened much deeper in the past. Often we talk about things that we think were, you know, 2,000 years ago that may have only been, you know, 500 years ago. Then you have things that we think were more recent and may have happened much distant in the much more distant past, or maybe recurring events, okay, that we think are singular, or maybe they're singular pursuant to a given age. You know? So, you know, that's how I look at that's how I look at that on the big picture. Let's move forward, turning the page. Do you think that Putin will send forces past Ukraine? Kenny's question. It's possible. It's possible. I know that all of the guarantees that they've made to their former European partners, to existing European business partners, and part of what you've seen in terms of the ambivalence of the European response and their kind of, you never heard them once say, we need to start making a bunch of more weapons. I mean, Germany said, oh, someday we're going to be a bigger army than Poland or something, but, or the biggest army in Europe, and Poland said, no, we're going to be, these are pipe dreams. There's no production orders underway that would suggest that they've moved on that since they've made that, those kinds of pipe dream goals announced. And they shouldn't have, man, because, you know, when you state your goals, sometimes, you know, you get 30 something percent of the sense of satisfaction of having accomplished the goal by stating your goals before. And I never say what I'm going to do. That one of the things that keeps me from getting things done is like announcing that I'm going to do it and then feeling good that I've said I'm going to do it. Now, save the feeling good for getting it done. That's why saying you're going to do it is always a bad idea. Not always, but you know. Do you think that the next question, turning the page, do you, oh, anyway, sorry, Kenny. Yeah, they could, but the agreements are, I think the spoken or unspoken agreement is that if they contain it to Ukraine, then we won't expect a further response from Europe. Okay. Do you think that the Federal Reserve and commercial banks in the U.S. and on Wall Street are really against the Great Reset? Well, first of all, for many years, and for a long time, the Fed and commercial banks and stuff have to go along with many of these things. The bifurcation between kind of like the resetist agenda and the normal functionings of things kind of co-align, and they kind of diverge. And some of this divergence is a little bit more recent in some ways. So just bear in mind that you also have the human factor. So what you're actually talking about is individuals in the Federal Reserve and commercial banks that just kind of see what things that the Great Reset is trying to do that work against their basic own functions. That's all. And that doesn't mean that in the past that the Fed and others have been led by people who want to identify those problems. But I know that there were changes made on the Fed. Actually, even with Obama, they began, I think, in 2015, they started doing things with the Fed differently. There had been kind of a practice ongoing for a while that was changed in terms of the sort of more cherished or age-old formulas about interest rates and inflation and how to do that, and you know, stagflation and things like this. How they've been doing things differently there recently, and so that difference alone created or shows us that there's different ideas going on. And you can see that commercial banks, right, who must lend to businesses, aren't happy, right, if you don't have an environment where businesses can exist and take loans. That's not the same thing as like foreclosing on things and it's the real assets or something. So, yeah, I think that that you obviously have an inter-elite conflict going on, and there are things which, you know, bankers as a class and the banking families and the historical legacy banking families are actually, and this is why it's kind of confusing, because these bankers are behind and actually leading this Great Reset agenda. But you have managers and you have people that have actually practical jobs. Like, for example, let me give you an analogy. All right. There's a military and it's going to war with another country, and that military knows that it can't win. Right. Or thinks it can't win and it's not playing to win. But the captains and the generals, like, or the field commanders rather, and the captains on the ground, like actually leading forces, like they are there to win and they want to win. And that's their consciousness and that's their mindset. And so then they're not only at war with the enemy, but then they're kind of always fighting with command and always having this conflict with, you know, maybe a country that isn't even in the war to win it, Iraq, Afghanistan, right? So think about, just in a way, think about the relationship between managers and the functions of commercial banks versus these kind of more cult-driven, cabal-driven, long-term social engineering projects to get around hard problems that arise from the disinflationary consequences of new applied labor-saving technologies. All right. How much we need to pay for a ticket on the Danube from Belgrade to Odessa after the special military operation is over is the question. This guy says, I think it's going to be just 5 rubles, which is like 5 cents, but that'll be the equivalent of $500 by that time in the U.S. Great joke. God bless. Thanks. Next question, turn the page. What do you think about U.S.-funded NGOs in Russia that are declaring a goal to decolonize Russia, like the Free Buryatia, New Tuva, Bashnat Politik? These groups have a goal to start a separatism within Russia and create artificial racial hatred in Russia. It's kind of terrifying for me. It's not going to work out very well. It's not going to work out very well. And it's a lot like with Native Americans in the U.S., okay? Despite what the left says in the U.S. about today, about contemporary attitudes, they're completely wrong. American people, regardless of, you know, where their forefathers originated from, American people all have a great and profound respect, except for sociopaths and pedophiles and Satanists, have a great respect for Native Americans. I actually had one person in mind when I said those three. I won't say who. This guy just hates Native Americans for some reason. I guess if you hate black people, it makes sense to hate Native Americans. But they have a lot of respect. And people get it. And no one denies that a lot of Indians were done dirty and that there's been even great crimes, you know. And in Russia, it's a different thing. But actually, the indigenous people in Russia were not really moved around and not like kill. I mean, you had stuff, population movements like much later on, like with Stalin and stuff. And I think Catherine the Great did some games too. But most of it, what you have is the blending of these people. So the Russian approach with a lot of what Turania, okay, we're actually talking about it, the indigenous people of Turania, the indigenous people of Russia, let's say prior to these excursions of growth of like Catherine the Great's Russian Empire. Because at one point in time, Russia is kind of like a country like Poland surrounding Moscow, right? In terms of its size, maybe its orientation. And there was another entity to its east which was like the Russia of the time, and it was definitely had a more Asiatic character, but, you know, Turco-Slavic, you know, like kind of Mongo-Turco-Slavic character. And at that time in history, people even thought that some of these were like, you know, Indian or Chinese characteristics. Isn't that interesting? But more like how the Spanish were in the New World, not the way that the left bemoans the Spanish in the New World, but the way that the Spanish actually were in the New World with the intermarriage and stuff, I suppose what racialists would call miscegenation. And that's been really the reality of it. That, and these U.S.-funded NGOs in Russia are trying to use this decolonization discourse that has blossomed in recent years in a strange way. And I know this is weird, and it's hard to kind of explain to people who aren't from the West, but if you're, there are, okay. Do you know how people talk about having baggage or having complexes, right? And we can't, even though we like to point out when people have a complex, like when it frustrates us or when you can see that that's the obstacle. I mean, if you're more of a confrontational person, because it can backfire, and you want to tell the person like, hey, this seems to be like a complex that you're having. Not, this sounds like a you problem, not like a me problem, right? This sounds like not a world problem, but a you problem, okay? And so a lot of this anti-decolonialist stuff, in its origin, if you talk about maybe, you know, books from the 60s that were generated in this genre, you have like Camus or, you know, The Rebel. You have this body of work, but really you're talking about, you know, triggers, right? So, but that's what people have to work through. And those things are real to an extent, but it's, but, and they shape you. But part of the, when we talk about, oh, get over it, well, that's part of like how, you know, boys and men are raised. They hit the age 11, 12, 13, and they're told, hey, tough shit, here's a straw, suck it up, that's life. And some girls are told that too. Some girl, other, many girls are coddled. Some boys are coddled too, and then they say, hey, how come you act like a fag? Hey, come on, princess, that's why you say, stop acting like a bitch. It's not that there's a problem when women are that way. The problem is when boys kind of behave in ways that don't accept that you got to suck it up. And a lot of decolonial, or, you know, a lot of decolonial discourse is and like decolonize your mind. Well, we all, you know, appreciate that that Bob Marley song. You know, you must liberate yourself from mental slavery. Only you can, right, free your mind. Like, that's very true. And that's actually at a lot of the kernel of the original decolonial, anti-colonial discourse at the personal level, is recognizing maybe your inferiority complex and kind of like we talk about soft power, right? So if you're an Algerian and stuff like that, and then everywhere you go, everyone talks about Paris, 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 and you think that Paris is the center of the world, right? And you're going to have this, you're going to have like this fucking complex because you don't look like the people of Paris and you're not from Paris. So you're kind of, by accepting this, you are like a second or third class person, okay? So there are very ugly trends in Russian culture that are just the normal kind of small-mindedness of people, okay? That, like in Moscow, and people complaining about people from the Soviet Union being in Moscow, basically. Like, that's so fucking retarded. And that kind of shit is going to fuel these NGOs. So if you're like a Russian in Moscow and you complain while you enjoy being in Moscow, which, by the way, you know, the wealth and the whatever of Moscow and the jobs that you have there, largely in the history, the recent 20th century was possible because of all this development and resources going to Moscow from Kazakhstan, the Caucasus. Okay, that's the reality. So then now the Soviet Union's collapsed and you have maybe some of these states don't get along with each other, and then people want to blame, you know, people. So that's going to fuel that stuff, frankly. So it's dumb. It's fucking dumb for Russians, like Russians, and that's whatever the fuck that means. That's actually kind of a newer concept, by the way. As much as they think that's an original, referring to an original people, that's a new concept of a Russian. Okay? And it's a distinction that obviously occurs more recently than not. So, because in the Soviet Union, you didn't have to be Russian to be Russian. You could be Soviet. You could be, you know, Azeri, Armenian, Kazakh, Latvian. You know, you see what I'm saying? But now, if you're not, and if you're in Russia with those things, you're a Russian citizen. And you don't, if you don't want to hyphenate your existence or tell your fucking biography every time you introduce yourself, which, you know, people don't always want to do. I know I don't. I'm a mix of all kinds of things. I'm an American, and that's like how Russians are. So I think the fetish that Russians are like a pure race or things like that is not a true concept that is dominant in Russia. Those people actually want a smaller Russia. Okay, so this is actually part of an ecosphere, Azra, thank you for your question, where the Soros NGOs are both promoting Nazi white supremacist concepts of what a Russian is, and towards a small Russia, putting the cart before the horse about how economics works, thinking that it's Moscow that's feeding, thinking that it's Moscow, the city, that's feeding the countryside, and not understanding that it's the countryside that's feeding the city. And basically being an extension of Gladio B neo-Nazi operations in the post-Soviet sphere. Then, because you have this problem-reaction-solution game that they play, then those same NGOs get behind the autonomous, the peoples of autonomous oblasts or autonomous republics inside of Russia, or in the, you know, areas like near Siberia or in the Caucasus. You know, basically the other, you know, 8 time zones, right? Out of 11 or 9 or whatever out of 11, all those people, that's the game that they play. I'm talking about the US funded NGOs. That's why they've been banned from Russia. But I think that if you actually look at Eurasian or neo-Eurasian discourse in Russia, which is in line with their formalized geopolitical goals, economic integration, non-interference into domestic affairs in Central Europe, but you're talking about continental civilizational integration, economic, as the foundation. This is at odds with these ideas, like in this new way that they've put out, like decolonization discourse in Russia. These are, and I wanted to talk about a little bit where these ideas come from, but like if you're from like an Indian reservation, or you are from like a major city and you're like an urban person of color, okay, just understand, if you're not, you will learn something, a different perspective, okay? Like the decolonization discourse, okay, has a liberating component to it. If you take the lesson that you are the one that has the whatever, the baggage from it, okay, that your vision, because see, here's the thing, what's called decolonization discourse has nothing to do with the original ideas, okay? Like, for example, with critical race theory, in looking specifically at identical case-to-case, apples-to-apples convictions, in explaining why you have sentencing disparities that are race, clearly the only, and this is how you, because I've had to do these before, I've had to do these contract violations and do basically private trials in favor of workers versus employers when the accusation was racial discrimination, effectively, okay, or prejudice. And it's a very, very hard thing to prove. And the criteria of establishing it is very hard. You can't just claim it because you're a person of color and you didn't get the job. You have to show that it was beyond all of these things, including personality issues. That was a deciding factor. And in critical race theory, originally, like the old one, that wasn't what's become, okay, there is this legitimate approach in addressing, look, there are these disparities in sentencing that cannot be explained by prior arrests, that cannot be explained by anything pertaining to that individual, which is the foundation of justice. In other words, it almost looks like judges are saying, well, since black people tend to get in trouble again anyway, let's give this black person a longer sentence. And that's kind of what started to look like was happening. I mean, that is kind of like what's happening. But even though that's true, and that can be solved, by the way, that can be solved, that has been extrapolated into the justification for an entire revision of American history, which is not only counterfactual, and that's the less problem, by the way, but promotes themes of inherent victimization, which perpetuate the very same victim mentality, which the original authors of texts that found that lay the foundation for decolonization theory or anti, you know, post-colonial theory or post-colonial sociology, all right, the lesson that you learn from that is actually to suck it up. And that's how it's been twisted, okay? Stay right with us. We'll be back in 30 seconds. If you thought, sorry, we are back from our little break. Thanks for bearing with me. So we're talking about sucking it up, okay? And the difference between how people like Camus and others were looking at the consequences of being of, or, you know, if you're like a black kid in a mostly white suburbs, or like when they had the Brown versus Board of Education, right? And they put the little girl on the stage to show the internalized preference for the dominant race. So the little black girl chose the little white doll because they were saying, and this is probably not wrong, because that's what the culture promotes, right? It's not for nothing that Candace Owens wants to appeal to an audience not based on her race, which means, you know, everybody, which is good. But you can see the kind of Cupid doll, you know, rose lightening, bleach cream foundation, hair straightening, like the whole thing you have to do. These are parts of the kind of the thing that we talk about with, you know, post-colonial or whatever discourse, right? But that's very different from Soros coming in and promoting an agenda of problem, reaction, solution, where it's actually the Western NGOs that are creating neo-Nazism and white supremacism in Russia. These are alien ideas. If you understand the Slavic, like, yes, if you want to criticize the Soviet Union because Marxism is a German philosophy, well, racism is like also specifically Anglo-Saxon, and it has to do with the nature, the evolution of Anglo-Saxon society and things like this. And, you know, it's overcoming its heterogeneity, the, you know, with the Utes and the Welsh and the Brits and the, you know, all the different ethnicities that make England, then the Normans, and then kind of why they preferred a class system. This is what Oswald Spengler explains in the difference in works like Prussianism and Socialism, and the difference in a sort of deconstruction, critique, and appreciation of Marx, but also critique and that of the work of August Bebel, the German anti-oligarch labor leader, August Bebel. So a lot of actually this stuff is all mixed up. So what you want to do is look at how the Russian society doesn't fit that mold of being a white, you know, racist state. Because it's not a white racist state, and because neo-Eurasianism actually kind of is more the preferred and growing trend, and neo-Eurasianism in Russian society promotes the integration and plurality of Russian peoples, like as a plural, or that the Russian people are made up of all these peoples. You see what I'm saying? And that was what Putin said at that big Trump-like arena rally that had whatever 250,000 people standing around, 80,000 people inside. And when he said at the beginning of the special military operation, or like in March when he did that big rally, his approval ratings around have, you know, jumped up from like 60 to 80 around the conflict. And that's what was said. And that's the attitude. And a lot of these ideas about, you know, we talked about, you know, certain people in Moscow. Actually, it's very interesting because we talk about liberals, which is, like Western liberalism is a foreign import into Russia. White racism is a foreign import into Russia. Decolonization theory is a foreign import into Russia. Marxism was a foreign import into Russia. Like, all these things were foreign imports into Russia. But all that said, in Moscow, some of the same pro-Western, you know, liberals, and there'll be like a lesbian journalist, a man-hater, Anglophile, but they'll also be, you know, very, oh, I'm tired of all these Chechens and Kazakhs in Moscow. Oh, what are they? Why with those stupid red shoes and those Beatles haircuts? Those bowl cuts. You see them always in Moscow walking around with their little, shoes. They're like velvet suede, little Elvis shoes. And those black bowl cuts looking like, looking like Ringo. And that's gonna tear up Russia. That's very stupid thinking. So yeah, you can get, you know, that's how I would look at those NGOs. It's good that they were banned. Dear XF, would you introduce a link reference about why cultural Marxism is not the right term, which explains it concise and to the point? I did not have time to listen to your live stream. I'm not sure that I've written an essay on that, but, you know, that comes from me, so you won't find another link or reference saying it as I say it. I mean, I think other people might have said it should be better called cultural capitalism, okay? And I think that's incorrect as well. But, you know, that's how it goes. I'm sorry that I don't have more other than to say, you know, to figure out maybe how to get your hands on that episode. But you will find people saying cultural, if you just Google or whatever, I mean, I hate to promote that, but if you just search Masoud, Mr. Shaketi, about just saying cultural Marxism or cultural capitalism maybe are good search terms or something like that. Things like that might give you good, you know, but it won't be what I'm saying. And a lot of that stuff might be even like communists saying what they think. You see what I mean? So, you know, it's going to be a mixed bag. So Phil, do you think there is a plan? This is the next question from Phil. Do you think there's a plan by the East to go onto a gold standard? The East, well, Russia is already effectively declared a gold floor. So I think that's substantial. You know, the thing is that the nice thing about what Russia's doing, I know this is going to sound weird, but it's going to improve, like anyone who's like traded and dealt with Russia with that, this is going to, the way that they're doing their currency is going to positively influence other currencies in a funny way. I mean, in the way that makes it good for people to have those currencies, not in terms of the people who can keep printing those currencies, is what I mean. Yes. Yacinda is possessed and has her soul sold already. Someone else is living in that body. Yeah, so she does these weird, contorted, like fake expressions. And it's so much like Amber Heard when she suddenly said, and then my dog stepped on a bee. And I was talking about it like with somebody. And like, yeah, that was from her acting class because as a sociopath, she has no thing. There's nothing that have happened in her life as traumatic as that. Like, so in the acting school, and they're saying, okay, you need to think, reach back to that most painful memory that made you cry. And it was like, oh, my dog stepped on a bee and I was 4 years old and I cried. You know, I was like, that's in her mind. Okay. And same thing with Yacinda. It's like she's told, you know, you want to look concerned when you say this, but her face is all fucking cracked. I mean, she looks like a meth whore. And then when she makes that concerned face, you're like, my God, you're 37 years old? For the love of Christ, I don't know. That's not from a tanning bed. I mean, this is something else. This is so weird. This is so bizarre. Because now, if this was just like a nice person, it would be kind of mean, very mean to point these things out about it, right? But we're actually trying to, like, kind of uncover where evil comes from and what are people's motivations. Like, that's so fascinating to me, are people's motivations. And, like, having that kind of, I don't know, like, being a replicant who's only programmed to live on the earth for 45 years so that when you're 38, you look like you're 70, that must be fucking strange. And I'm trying to figure out, Yacinda, through that, like, how that affected her consciousness. Like, is she looking for her creator to extend her lifespan, like in Blade Runner? Like, that's what I want to know about Yacinda Ardern. Christina De Jesus asks, do you believe the underground tunnels as it relates to human trafficking? I don't believe in the delusions of anyone who thinks that, you know, the First Lady appointed them to head like a Pentagon task force about it. The sick thing about human trafficking is that it occurs at the level at the very high levels that the people most concerned about it say, but there's something more disturbing about it is that it doesn't require tunnels because of the actual existing reality of how things work in the world, of these institutions, adoption centers, orphanages, and that whole network, the Centers for Lost Children, things, all this stuff. You actually don't need tunnels if you actually look at how the system works. That's the sick thing about it. It's almost like we want there to be underground tunnels because this can't be just happening out of child protective services and stuff like that, but it is. That's what's crazy about it. So that, do you think any of the Epstein clients will face prosecution? Yeah, by the great prosecutor, but not in this tiny, you know, little testing ground of life, no. But in eternity, they will. That's the whole point of this that we're here for. What are my thoughts about CERN? Do you think it has anything to do with what's going on? Yes, CERN. Yes, it has a lot to do with Satanism. I mean, they are. I mean, I know this sounds weird and stuff, but they are Satanists at CERN, and they do fetishize destruction and stuff, and just look at the coded stuff and a lot of their messages. Like, citizens figured this out. This is, you know, now I happen to know things about CERN, and I've been privy to opinions from, you know, retired KGB assets, if there's such thing as retired, about CERN, what some Russians in leadership and intelligence believe that CERN really is or know CERN to be, or, you know, wanted me to think that that's what they think, because that could be that too. But I've gotten this from different people on the Russian side. So, you know, I mean, you know, I don't, because of the way I speak and kind of my informal approach here, and what I'm doing in my life right now. Some of you guys don't know that that the State Department and the CIA and the Treasury Department believe that I've worked, you know, for like the immediate advisors around Putin on media information war projects. That's like their, you know, that's their thing. Reshetnikov, Glazyev, Dugin, others, whatever. There's some things going on at CERN. And I think for just this morning, kind of more science-minded in the AM and stuff, and not being at the witching hour or whatever, I would just say, you know, I would just say that, look, there is not consensus, okay, about what makes planes fly, right? Is it the air pressure vacuum? Is it the push or is it pull, right? I'm talking about lift. There is not consensus on what makes planes fly. The fact that we can make planes fly doesn't mean that we understand the physics of flight. It just means that we can do it. For example, a dog can run. A dog cannot explain to you the physics of running. The dog cannot explain that it's actually, there's a certain point in time when no feet are on the ground. Wow. Like just for a fraction of a second, like in many walking, there's a moment when you're like completely off the ground. Dog cannot explain that, just does it. And humans do a lot of things, and our scientists make a lot of big claims about how those things work that are not how those things work necessarily. And they use the fact that we can get them to work for saying that we understand how they work. And those are two different things. Okay? So CERN, definitely something. We'll talk about it later. But just because what they're actually in search of is, on one level, they're actually in search of the atom. The theory of the atom has not ever been quite established. If by atom we mean the fundamental, you know, the fundamental most base component of matter, right? In other words, if we live in a material world and things are made of matter, then there has to be the smallest piece of matter that matter is made out of. And that was actually an errant thought. It actually turns out that at the foundation of matter is a lot of empty space. 99.9999% empty space. And they approach that even within the contemporary model of the atom, that the atom was primarily empty space. Like the distance between the atomic nucleus and, well, you know, like in Bohr's model of the atom, which is very flawed, you have like almost like the protons and electrons are like going around as if planets around a sun type of thing. But one thing that was kind of accurate is sort of like the atom is like the solar system and all that empty space between planets, like it's mostly empty space, and all that empty space surrounding the sun is like the nucleus of an atom and the atom, right? So understanding what's at that fundamental level, even though they've claimed that we have an atom, then they keep saying, oh, there's, you know, these subatomic particles and, you know, oh, you know, smaller than electrons, smaller than these, and you have like muons, gluons. I mean, that was the state of things in, you know, 2004, you know. I mean, I haven't gone down that, and, you know, what are the, you know, latest subatomic particles they're claiming to have discovered, but, you know, the process for which they claim those to discover is almost like, you know, looking into a fucking, you know, a hat and then, you know, and then, you know, having letters appear or something like that in your mind. Okay. Joseph Smith or whatever. So it's kind of weird. It's kind of a weird thing they do at CERN. What they're looking at and what they think they're looking at may not be related at all in any way. And then there's this thing that they seem to be trying to open up the fabric. Like they have this sense that time space is like a fabric because it's sort of explained that way by analogy, but then you have this weird shit that happens all the time in applied aspects of trying to take theoretical physics into the applied spectrum, where because what happens in theoretical physics is because it's a gobbledygook nonsense bullshit construction based upon a combination of bizarre heuristics and language games, confusing you by using words that seem to have normal meanings in regular speech actually don't mean those things in the language of mathematics. You know, what you have with theoretical physics primarily is an understanding, you know, at one level, and this is a lot of stuff behind CERN, is that, you know, you need, society needs to put research money into mathematics, but everyone hates math and math is boring, but outer space and spaceships are fucking cool. So you just pretend that through the study of mathematics that you're learning about outer space. Let's see. Lisa asks, so we all know Ukraine is corrupt. At least when it comes to America, they're corrupt. No question. So my question is the war really warranted? It wasn't, I would just stop there and say, it wasn't like there was necessarily a thing that they really could decide not to do it at the level of decision-making, how this occurs. They'd be like, it's not that it, there's no other choice. So their sense, if you look, and they showed some, you know, radar and satellite stuff and show, hey, look, this is a lot of stuff building up. It looks like there's going to be a March 8th attack, or March 8th, March 11th, thereabouts. It looks like that's what was winding up for Ukraine to attack the breakaway republic. So that necessitated the intervention. And the war being warranted, you're talking about, was it absolutely necessary? And in my sense of things, based upon my assessment of the leadership decision-making process, is not a personality state. They don't have problems of Abilene paradox, groupthink. They seem to have compartmentalization in decision-making processes, so that you don't have, you know, contamination by competing interests or groupthink, on the other hand, and all of that, you know, and also they exhibit a high degree of sophistication in strategic thinking and midterm, long-term planning. So all those taken together, and given that this is not a elective warfare, this is not like, oh, let's find a little tiny Haiti or some little, you know, fucking bullshit in Eritrea or Somalia and start fucking around. That's elective warfare. And that's really like the talk about Moloch, is the god of elective warfare, and the loot that you get from elective warfare, whether it's Haiti or elsewhere. The human loot is part of that. Human sacrifice and elective warfare is Moloch. And so I don't, you know, what you're asking is Russia's war Molochian? And Russia's war is not Molochian. It's not satanic. ABC asks, good morning, XF. Love your energy and continuous effort. Keep it up. Pow, pow. Two questions, if you don't mind. One, we are almost 6 months into the special operation, and it doesn't seem to stop anytime soon. Since autumn, winter is just around the corner, do you think this will have an impact on the strategy from both Russia, NATO, due to weather? Yes. I think that this month, next month, is going to be very big. I think that September, October, November, you have American elections in November. There's a lot of things that are going to happen. I think that, look, this is what you have to remember. Russia stormed in and seized a lot of territory all at once, and you saw all of that when they basically blitzkrieged. With these positions that they're pounding softened up, and if they're willing to increase their ratio of losses to losses, enemy losses, by 20%, right now I think that you're having, because of the way this conflict and the second generation warfare advantage that Russia has, is therefore made this a second generation warfare conflict, in terms of you're attriting by artillery at a distance, like no different from Napoleon. You're attriting at a distance with artillery, and then you're using your army not to defeat an army, but to go in and clean up and occupy the town. So you have, on cleanup operations, you're going to have like only a 1 in 20 or 1 in 30 chance of a casualty. And in the war of attrition, you have the enemy is taking five times as many casualties. Okay? So when you've attrited a position and the people are three-fourths bombed out and their defensive positions are knocked out and they're not allowed to retreat and they've got missing fingers and they're out of food and they're being told to stay in the machine gun nest and shoot at anything that moves, okay? If you send a real fighting force adequate for the job into that location, they're going to take very minimal losses. Very minimal losses. Special forces cleanup sweep. I would say they take, for every 20 Ukrainians or 30 Ukrainians they kill, they lose one guy. And then on the attrition front, I'd say Russia's losing one for every five. So you would have, you know, Russian losses at around 8,000 to 10,000 on from the Russian army, and then maybe another 5,000 to 7,000. I would say altogether just under 20,000 Russian killed in action, maybe 15,000 Russian killed in action, and about 100,000 Ukrainians killed in action, and minimally not less than 75,000 to 80,000 killed in action, and not less than 10,000 Russian combined forces killed in action, but as many as 20,000. So if Russia's willing, if Russia might take a bigger hit on the cleanup operation end of things, and might take may, you know, I don't know where they are with their attrition and their softening up the terrain, but they're, what I'm trying to say is that September, October, and this period before winter sets, before first snow and before the frost, of course, you're going to need a very big push that is going to be, that requires a very big buildup and a very big push and take a bunch of stuff within a period of like a month and a half. And I think that's coming up. I think that they actually need to have Nikolaev and Odessa by November, you see, or you're putting things off into next year, into like basically March again. So that's the good question about the weather. And then your second question is about Taiwan. Strategically and from timing perspective, isn't it in China's best interest to take Taiwan now while NATO is keeping busy with Ukraine? I mean, yeah, that's, you're right. If China really needs American forces to be stretched out, and or NATO forces to be stretched out for that, but NATO is not busy with Ukraine. It's not even adequate to Ukraine. It's not adequate to China. There's not really like a military thing that's holding China back. It's that Taiwan, you know, Taiwan sells $120 billion a year in product to China. And they have a good relationship. China and Taiwan have a very good relationship in most all sectors of society and business and stuff. And it's really just this, Democratic Progressive Party that Soros has gotten into power there that has this bizarre Taiwanese nationalism, which nobody really believes unless they're like that 5% of the voting population that's hardcore about this party that basically did a stolen election stuff. That's why you have a crisis, like a little crisis in Taiwan right now. They got like a very stupid I support the present thing government in there, and the government is actually not effectual either in being anti-China. It's so much of this is like simulation with that stuff. So I don't think it's China has so many mechanisms to like pressure Taiwan to change its government that don't involve military outcomes. Like, don't you think that businesses in Taiwan, which combined are, you know, $1 trillion in the past 12 years to China. Like, don't you think that we're talking not a billion, a trillion, like a 1,000 billion. Don't you think that that is a very strong, like, impact on the real Taiwanese policy on China and the real China policy on Taiwan? So I'm not ruling out, like, more of this military theatrics around Taiwan, but it kind of distorts the real picture. All of the Taiwanese supported one China policy. And there's been some change in thinking among some population, like in the past 10 years, because of this invention of Taiwanese nationalism, but most people don't buy into it. And it doesn't really motivate their lives, like, on a daily basis, quite frankly. People are just not that ideological. Yuri, the Soviet Russian bear, asks, should Russia just give Western Ukraine to Poland, Hungary, and Romania? Well, they could give it to them, but they shouldn't just do it. They should offer it, like, meaningful parts of this and appeal that would appeal to their most irredentist and nationalist trends, especially in the case of Poland and Romania, where those nationalist trends are fomented into anti-Russian hysteria. You know, mind you, Hungary, Orban, as a politician, got his start as an anti-Russian leader. He was promoting in 1989, very important for Hungarian stuff, vis-a-vis the 1956 Hungarian uprising, anti-Soviet. A lot of his politics are based in this. And he has shown how to separate anti-Russianism from anti-communism. It helps that Russia is not a communist state for a long time now, 30 years, but, you know, a lot of people kind of just still move forward with these fucking Vatican conspiracy theories and stuff like this. I won't get into it, but you know what I'm talking about. Let's see here. I may have gone out of order with some questions, so let me just look again. Let's see. AA asks, Biden is old and senile. Kamala is ignorant and unintelligent. I know this is a question. I know we're getting into a question here. Kamala is unintelligent. Okay. Agreed. Do you agree? Yes. Okay. Who is ruling the USA today? Who is making operative political decisions? If there is a committee, then decisions can't be quick and on time. If there is one man, then who is he? So who and how is ruling USA now? Well, okay, the parameters of the possibilities of both global economic outcomes and the military side of diplomacy and geopolitics and stuff, a lot of these things were pre-shaped and contained by the Trump administration to limit the potential damage that the subsequent administration could do. So when you see Biden, right, you're asking who's making these political decisions like this in terms of these things, and there is a lot of committee. And decisions are not quick, nor are they on time, nor can they agree, and there are different committees, and they can't agree with each other because there are different elites in America that are running different operations, and there's a lot of autonomy in these operations that are run from different elites out of the U.S., at least three, probably two at minimum. But you can see that there's a reason that Lavrov declared 7 or 8 years ago even that the United States was non-agreement capable. There's no one in the U.S. that you can talk to that's an elected leader, the president, the foreign minister, cannot make an agreement, cannot sign an agreement. They can sign one. It won't affect what... For example, this is what we're talking about. John Kerry, as a Secretary of State, can sign an agreement with Lavrov about something in Syria. Oh, but John McCain, who's like the shadow Secretary of State or whatever, you know, running around, is going to be financing and helping to, you know, run leadership for fucking ISIS. So how can you make an agreement? How can the Russians make an agreement with Kerry about Syria if they have a non-negotiable person, a non-agreement capable entity running around creating the problem? So, and some of that is so that they, you can say, you, they can try to make that look like a strength, like, oh, look at, we have, you know, dissimulated power. Look at, we've deconstructed, you don't know where we're going or where, wow, we're like ninjas. No, no, that's how they can play it off. That's like how you try to make look, I meant to do that. You know, like when Inspector Clouseau is like walking in to look at the crime scene of the Pink Panther diamond and like the fucking automated, you know, metal walls come down and he jumps forward like in fear and he acts like he was just taking a double quick step. You know, I meant to, oh no, I was just, you know, I meant to do that. Those were my ninja senses. So the men in Biden's earpiece is Obama. We know that Biden wears an earpiece and he says the things to say. And Obama, in an interview just before, said, I would like to do a third term and maybe do it like have someone, and I just, you know, is the president, but I'm actually talking through like an earpiece or something. Like he literally said that. It's out there to find. Maybe someone will share it in the comment section. Okay? So it's like that. A lot of foreign policy stuff. Trump people are holding back pushes for chaos and, you know, for their own interest, self-interested reasons or whatever. You know, you don't have to look at good guys and bad guys and stuff. Just look at inter-elite conflict. Corn Pop's mom asking, how are you able to remain safe? You know, well, when I was preparing, you know, before I left the United States to fight Soros as a forward deployed, instead of, I got tired of fighting defensive battles and I wanted to like forward deploy and take on, I thought if we started fighting Soros in the kind of the peripheral Europe and these areas where these color revolutions pop up, this was like a decade ago, that we could prevent this kind of thing from happening in the US. So, you know, as a one-man army, I failed, right? But so, and the color revolution did happen in the U.S., right? So, but I had FBI at my house wanting to have a conversation. I won't name names, but a female friend of mine who many of you follow on another channel was visited by the intelligence service recently. Oh, just asking some friendly questions. Do you plan on leaving the country anytime soon? Don't. What? So I didn't like that. And, you know, and then I had a grandmother pass away in 2014. And 2013, 2014, I returned to the States for the for her funeral. I was detained by TSA on my way in for like 6 hours. In a little white room with a closed circuit TV. Do you want some chips? Yeah, thanks. When can I leave? Oh, I'm not the guy who knows. Okay. Can I talk to a lawyer? Can I leave? No. What happens if I try to leave? You'll be arrested. So I'm not arrested now. Can I leave? No. Oh. So let's look at our questions. Why doesn't the Russian Federation bomb Kiev in retaliation for shelling of civilian targets in Donetsk? Because despite how things get written about, very few things are ever retaliation for something. I mean, you have a target in mind all along or you don't. It's, you don't bomb civilian populations in Kiev in response to civilian populations in Donetsk. It's a different mentality. You should know it. Mr. Gumilev, you would know that you don't win. You don't, if you want to run Ukraine, then you cannot, annihilate its residents. So maybe that's the thinking. And it's just, as a person, and I think you'll find, the more that your actions are predictable, in other words, can you be provoked? Are most of your actions responses to fucking shit that other people have done? You're kind of a weak person and you're a predictable person. And, revenge, retaliation, or whatever, fair comings or whatever, these are dishes best served cold. And not when predicted. And should not be seen as a way that your opponents... Like, if, for example, if the Kiev side, meaning the American cabal, or whatever, I don't even like to use the word American in there. I'm an American. They didn't ask me about that. But the cabal that runs a false flag operation through the U.S. military very often, or operating under the color of law falsely, they don't care about Baghdad or anything like this. They don't see them as human beings. So, that's one thing. So the Russians view the people of Kiev as, in a sense, Russians. So there's that. Other component there, of course, is just like if the cabal wanted to have a Russian strike on an important place that they can claim, this is civilian losses and stuff, then they only need to launch such on the Russians and knowing that the Russians are going to retaliate. So you don't want to fall into people's traps in life. You don't respond to people. Even in conversations, if somebody tells you something crazy, just like you don't have to say anything. 3, 4, 5 seconds is a long time. They'll feel that silence and you'll look at them and, meditate on what you're going to say and say the right thing. Don't let people throw you off balance. Don't let people shell you if they're trying to troll you or trap you into a retaliation, right? Here's the next question from Yuri, the Soviet Russian bear. What's the symbolism behind Zelensky's Vogue photo shoot? Let them eat cake. I think actually the whole regime is symbolized in the photo shoot. A guy was fired from Google for saying that AI had developed human emotions. Brandon asks, thanks Lulu. And I'm glad that some of my impressions work. Brandon asks, how do you organize your thinking? As far as in general day-to-day life, filters versus conduits. If I go to bed early enough, like by 11, I normally wake up with a bunch of ideas launching a lot of sorties on my brain. Like a lot, I get attacked or assaulted. They're not attacks. They're all positive ideas and inspirations. I invite them. I say subconsciously I invite them. I say like angels, thoughts, right? Emotions, angels, right? Love, inspiration, hope, these things I invite you. And the thoughts those are the thoughts that I have. See, you are not your thoughts. You are not your thoughts. So I then if there's a particular thing that is a particular idea of those that I hone in on, then I might bounce it off my wife. Say, honey, did you ever consider that? Remember we were talking about blah, 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 and how artificial intelligence is going to be the thing. Well, what if happened if there was like another planet, right? Like this kind of just, and that, you know, some people, they have to be up like at 3 a.m. to think like this. And that's because they've got their circadian rhythm cycle all messed up. You go to bed earlier and then you wake up inspired. The inspiration shouldn't come as a result of FOMO, like fear of missing out, and I'm just one click away. Oh, there's going to be breaking news if I just stay up past 2 a.m. I don't want to miss something happens, or like whatever people are doing with FOMO on social media. Instead, that inspiration comes in the morning. And then anything that I can get done after, like in the afternoon, is butter. You see what I'm saying? But then I'm already thinking about like kids come home from school, things like this and whatever. And, you know, you're always freshest on a good sleep in the morning. So I organize my thinking around that in terms of day to day, and filter. I use as little filter as possible. And I mean, I filter, I have heuristic filters and I have filters that are, you know, mechanistic, like already. And, you know, you would need to unwind from your whatever, synapse firing procedure, to have a real different methodology. So I would say it's more intuitive at this point, but I do challenge it, Brandon. And then on a given day, I'm often responding to, if there isn't like some thing that's developed very bigly with like the world, then I'm free to, return to long-term, cognitive projects and, you know, intellectual work on Great Reset, social theory, color revolutions, and psychology of, the mass psychology of protest and things like this. Next question. I'm just looking at questions. Let's see, Jonathan, how do you think, asks XF, how do you think the growing tensions between Muslims and European nationalists resolve itself given the current trends towards an EU collapse? American multiculturalism clearly doesn't work in most of Europe. Yeah, Merkel said so. I can't imagine how a state like Sweden, who's already ceded large segments of its territory to migrants, can actually assert itself without some kind of inevitable violent domestic conflict. Well, you have to think more creatively. Don't think in terms of violent domestic conflicts. If you think in terms of violent domestic conflicts, then number one, you're inviting all of those energies and you're creating those potentials in your life. And you're first going to generate the histamine response to a state which responds violently to the suggestion of violence. So first, you have to understand that you are co-creating your future reality and the way that you experience this reality. You know, I could be living in a, like you hear my voice and you think that we're in the same plane. I could be in a very different reality than you. I'm perceiving and existing when things are happening. My lens of interpretation tells me that other things are happening than maybe what you, I don't know. You see what I'm saying? I don't necessarily think that these are inevitable. So you have to, with any country, and is really just about freedom of information and freedom of assembly, and that your that every legal vote is counted and all illegal votes are thrown away, and or, you know, manufactured, mass printed, whatever, fake votes. We're not talking about illegal voters. We're talking about fake ballots. With those questions solved, then you will have very different parliamentary outcomes in Europe. If the politics is local, and if the issues are not single issue extremist, then you will succeed in politics. It's local. Let's see. Yuri asks, XF, should the Baltics be Russia's next target because of their rabid Russophobia and the oppression of ethnic Russian minorities in those nations? I believe the Russian state should be the protector of all Russians around the world. Yes, but you're Russian, so you think that. So if a Russian minority lives in your country, you'd better treat them like kings and queens. It was a joke. Just treat them like equals. I think that the Baltics are already like in the Russia, like kind of sites right now. I mean, it's definitely, they're targeted. I mean, just look at all the talk about, there was a suggestion to like militarily intervene over Königsberg, Kaliningrad. So could be. It's either this or basically the Balkans. It's either the Baltic or the Balkans. And it's not that it should be Russia's next target, but kind of like, where will the unavoidable crisis need to be dealt with? And then to what extent can Russia take initiative so that the actual moves are not, let's say, predictably responsive in terms of the scope or their timing? Yeah? Drags with Fist asks, will the multi-world develop a method to prevent the U.S. from gaslighting this bioweapon nightmare and at least castigate these psychopaths? Yeah, because the thing is, and that's what like a lot of, like in the 60s and 70s with like the James Bond stuff, you have like Spectre and like Evil or Dr. Evil, like from Austin Powers, or you have, Blofeld and stuff, right? And, or from the Inspector Clouseau movies, you have the former, was it the chief inspector? Dreyfus. And you always think about the Dreyfus affair. You could have these lone crazy people go like in some castle in Switzerland or something and have a bioweapon nightmare, right? So yeah, but I think that what has happened is you actually have like a maniacal cult like running the US, some aspect of the US, and are using American resources and American know-how and stuff, and using American diplomacy and American, governmental channels to set up their own kind of private psychopath moves that deal with whatever, gaslighting, bioweapons, and all these things. This is more like police action. You just have to kind of, we have to first kind of disconnect that this is like America and Americans per se, and that this is like a geopolitical issue, and this is really an issue from the question of these different emergent spheres of influence that are kind of growing in their sovereign dominance over their, as local, as regional hegemons. The U.S. might do these things, typically speaking, because we're talking about terrorism, right? Terrorism, okay? Terrorism, a lot of terrorism is state-sanctioned, but a lot of state-sanctioned terrorism are aimed towards, like, realizable goals. Like, there's, like, demands that go with these terrorist threats and stuff. But you could also just have crazies that do these because they want to do them, not to, as a shakedown or something like that, or hostage, taking the world hostage, but really just because they do want to kill. They're not looking for, do this or else we kill you all, but they just want to kill, right? So I think methods are more like law enforcement or having to, the thing, what you have to understand is that a lot of the methods that other parts of the world are developing to protect from terrorism from the cabal look a lot like the enclosure around our individual sovereign space and privacy. I mean, if you're in a society that's literally under attack, I mean, for example, if the U.S. sent contagious people to Wuhan at the military Olympics, the military World Games, from pathogens from Fort Detrick, or from Wuhan, laboratory of coronaviruses. but all you know goes back to actually like Bill Gates and Anthony Fauci, right? But so then you would actually have like, when you arrive at the airport, to do like a swab or something that really could detect, maybe, right, for these pathogens. And you really would have, I mean, biological warfare that attacks people based upon their, you know, ethnically specific DNA. That's already published, and it's already in the mainstream that's the direction of bioweapons. So, unfortunately, many of those methods, we talk about our tale of two cities or tale of two kingdoms, and how a conspiracy theorist might view the mutually hostile security provisions that two warring city-states make as being evidence of a conspiracy between those two city-states to implement a security apparatus. You see? We've talked about that before in the past. It's a great question, though. Somebody shared the interview with Obama talking about the Biden earpiece. And the quote was this: I used to say, if I can make an arrangement, well, I have to do my Obama. No, I'm not going to do Obama today. I used to say, if I can make an arrangement where I had a stand-in, a front man or a front woman, and they had an earpiece in, and I was just in my basement in my sweats looking through the stuff, and I could sort of deliver the lines, but somebody else was doing all the talking and the ceremony, I'd be fine with that. Talking about a third term, Obama remarked about a perhaps stealth third term to Stephen Colbert on CBS's Late Show. There it is. Do you believe in time? Christina De Jesus asks, do you believe in time travel? Please explain why or why not. Not in the way we consider it. I can't get, this is a subject for, you know, I have to be in a mode of thinking to get into that. And the descriptions cannot be short. In fact, that is its own show, but it's a great question. So I hope you're around later. Janine asks, what do you think about the accusation of false flag by KGP on apartment buildings in Moscow in the 90s, which led to the Chechen war? It could have been a false flag, or not so much a false flag. It could have been an event that it's more likely in terms of the orders and the chain of command and the cleanliness of how that was done, they probably called it like the losses taken to prevent the activity would have been greater than the losses to let it happen. And however they justified that, you know, that over what period of time and what do you mean by that? But that would have been more like the decision if it went that way. I don't rule it out. I don't, but it's not a false flag. It's actually the way it normally works is that the intelligence agency is aware of the activities of real terrorists, not false flag, but real terrorists. And rather than stopping them, they let them do it. So that's a possibility. All right. And possibilities are not evidence.
not evidence of anything except possibility. I just wouldn't read a government report on why it's impossible and be like, oh, that's, you know, there, it's settled. Do you see what I'm saying? Let's see. Let's remove this spam from Don Scavino. Another fucking Don Scavino, or what is the other one? Dr. Robert Kennedy Jr. No, he's not. What are you talking about? He's fake ass. Oh, man. XF, do you think the U.S. deliberately let COVID out? Yeah, something like that. I think so. If I'm allowed to an opinion, I think so. Something like that, whatever it is, you know. Yeah, something like that. Yuri's telling us when Nancy Pelosi was delivering the speech in March, right, after the conflict started, remember she was before the part, she said, she was trying to say Slava Ukraini, but she said like Slava Ukani, and apparently Slava Ukani means glory to Wuhan. Okay, people. So these are our questions for today. Someone asked there was another question actually that was a little bit supernatural. It was kind of asking about not time travel, but someone said, you mentioned before about aliens and travel. And I said, what I said was that that we should be as scientific as possible about the alien phenomenon. And when we are as scientific as possible about the alien phenomenon, and we remove steps relating to that phenomenon, which we are inferring but have no evidence of, then we should apply Occam's razor and remove those steps. So what I said was the consensus view, like if you get into actual Freedom of Information Act stuff and authenticated leaks, but mostly FOIA stuff, on the U.S.'s study of, you know, aliens or whatever and UFOs, but also different types of encounters of different kinds of close encounters, that they're, what they had figured out, right, was that these beings, even though we see crafts in this, what looks like crafts or something in the sky, okay, that those are not, that the crafts and the way we think about crafts aren't what's traveling through what we consider space. This is the mainstream consensus view. Okay, but that they travel via consciousness. That, okay. Now, what we actually see is materialization and dematerialization, okay? To add that they must have materialized after traveling X amount of light years through the time-space continuum or the fabric, whatever, is a purely inelegant addition to the observation that does not occur in the observation. All you actually have are materialization and dematerialization, and a probably sound hypothesis that this has to do with consciousness. I'm of the opinion that these entities do not travel from another location in the sense of how we consider it, like going to the store or flying around the moon, but exist in a different domain within consciousness, which is the fundamental of this existence. If that's why this search for subatomic particle behind subatomic particle, etc., goes nowhere. You might find an infinite fractal possibility to further miniaturize and create the expectation of what you're going to see going smaller and smaller and smaller scale. in a fractal pattern infinitely, because the existence being infinite, every particular point within that existence could be infinite. Just as there's an infinite number of numbers, there's an infinite number of numbers between each number. So the thing that you're looking for can be the thing that you find, and the way that you've oriented your quest towards the answer will predetermine the answers that you receive. So the way that we've set up our experiment, the way we set up our theory is only going to confirm that theory because of the nature of existence itself and the role of consciousness in determining the things that we are going to find. Does that make sense? So likewise, with travel and these beings, it's inelegant and unscientific, and we're completely just surmising and adding on top of things that we don't observe, that these things have traveled from some other great distance in the way that we imagine in the 1950s, you have fucking astronauts get into a goddamn rocket and like Disneyland fly to space. You see what I'm saying? That's not what's happening. So then why would we say that they've come from someone else, somewhere else? Because that's all narrative and beliefs that we've added into that. What we really should do is look at our own dreams, our own ability to travel, astral projection, whatever people call it, and then look at what these entities are doing. And then look at the negative interactions that people always have with these entities. You have to have a certain amount of emotional intelligence. And unfortunately, there are religious structures that work against emotional intelligence. But more lately, in the past couple of decades, it's a lot of secular structures that promote a lot of weak emotional intelligence. So people may not see, you see, people are encountering these entities and being violated and terrified. And if they thought that there was something wrong with them, you know, that would explain it. So they might even still think that these aliens are good, despite that they were tortured and probed and terrified. So you see what I'm saying? So there's certain issues in terms of emotional intelligence. Scientifically, you know, what you have to understand is that any being that could travel the distance to observe the beings on this planet would not also require the level of interaction in terms of the probing and stuff just to discover biological functions about the being. Does that make sense? Like, you're going to get that elsewhere. Actually, the emotional state that people experience and the fear from the encounter is the goal. And because these entities are not scientists looking for information, they are beings that the way that you must eat food. And that's also an issue, because think about all that stuff was alive, you know, and now you're eating it, right? They eat emotions. You know how, like, at the bottom of the ocean, there are those deep sea life that can only live there, and they don't get any sunlight, and they don't even eat. They are living off of the radiation. They're living off of the heat generated from the, you know, whatever's beneath that layer, like the lava or whatever. The fiery pits of hell under the bottom of the ocean, right? And that's what they're living off of. There's just a lot of things out there that we don't think about. We think about photosynthesis and plants, and you know, obviously need water and plant. Think about we just got this kind of stupid scientific paradigm and this dark, you know, a false reading of Plato. It's a kind of a Cartesian paradigm. We think that the mind and the body are totally different, and you know, we think that the things that feed us are not also happening at different levels at the same time. So that was what I was trying to say originally about. I wasn't saying that there are aliens, and I'm not saying that there's aliens that travel great distances. In fact, I'm saying that the system, the actual consensus view based on FOIA documents and experts that have come forward that have enough credibility in describing it, they say that it's consciousness. They say that these are entities traveling through consciousness. Okay, I'm agreeing that it's consciousness and that they do materialize and dematerialize, but I'm saying that these are materializing and dematerializing in interaction to human beings and not having traveled great distances. That this is an existence that's tucked within this existence, that this is like a dimension tucked within this dimension. It occupies, you know, what you might otherwise call the same, you know, even a colliding orthogonality, or even like it might seem like there's two objects that occupy the same space or something, but one is actually in another field of existence. And that field of existence that can emanatize, or that entity, that consciousness can emanatize out of that field of existence into this one. Okay, that's what's going on at CERN also, with talking about they're trying to get to this matter, what level they can open up this portal. So anyway, that's for today. That's our questions. Good enough. I don't like talking about that stuff at this hour of the day. It's just a different audience and a different way of understanding things. And then people are like, why is this guy talking about Ukraine? Like, well, you might not know my own history either. I'm not that interesting to myself, but you know, some people would say that there's interesting stuff to look at in the background there. That leads me to say the things that I say. All right. I'm out for today. Peace. Have a good one. I'm going to enjoy the rest of my day. I hope you too.